Morning. Thank you for coming this morning. And as Len mentioned, this morning I'd like to talk to you about our experience mobilizing health professionals to assist with our advocacy efforts on immigration detention reform. As you know, advocacy with policymakers is one critical method to achieving social justice objectives and to holding governments accountable. I'd like to start today by giving you a brief outline of the immigration detention system and how we determine to document the human rights violations occurring therein and to raise awareness of the various flaws in the system. Next, I'd like to talk about how we've engaged health professionals in our advocacy efforts with policymakers, including the obstacles we've faced, examples of current projects that they're engaged in, as well as best practices and results that we've achieved so far. So first, looking at the immigration detention system, I just wanted to give you an idea of the scope of this system. Of course, you know, an entire presentation or even a course could be done about this, but very briefly, to help you understand that there are over 250 facilities across the country, and these are all different kinds of facilities. Some of them are government-owned and operated large facilities, others are private contract facilities, and then there's also rented space in local jails, prisons, places like that. So the system affects over 400,000 people each year. They're detained for varying amounts of time. Some people are in the system for only a day. Others at the other end of the spectrum may be in the system for years as they're waiting for their cases to wind their way through the system. But the average number of days spent in detention is 30. And we think that's, you know, a considerable amount of time. It can have 30 days in detention if you're not receiving essential quality health care in a timely manner can be really, can affect your health, can negatively impact your health in many ways. So the cost of the detention system is roughly $100 per person per night. You can see that the money involved in this system is huge. It's over $3 million daily just to run this huge system. And the reason that it's so huge is because we have a congressional mandate that there be 33,400 beds available per night to hold immigration detainees. And that's another reason why the system has to rent jail space from the local and the county jails, because there's simply not enough space in the government facilities. And then the most important thing, or the most egregious thing that we see about this system, is that 113 people have died in immigration detention since 2003. And the reason we look at the statistics back to 2003 is because that's the time when Department of Homeland Security formally took over the system that was previously run by the Immigration and Naturalization Services. The model of immigration detention is what we call a detain for deportation model. That is, the idea is to keep the people in the system just healthy enough to deport them. There's no mandate or intention really to maintain or restore health, because the idea, and actually the true assumption, is that most of the people will be out of the system within 30 days probably. So the focus is on acute care with a significant lack of attention to chronic conditions. So things like, you know, serious things like hypertension, asthma, diabetes, even AIDS are not getting the treatment that they need because the system assumes that they'll be out of it. But obviously people who have these kind of conditions are often in serious jeopardy if they don't receive the medicines that they need in a timely manner. The system is also marked by very strong security concerns. Although this is meant to be administrative, it's not meant to be punitive incarceration. It's meant to be administrative because they're, you know, it's just they're waiting for their cases to go through the system. But there are strong security concerns by Department of Homeland Security nevertheless. So there's an overuse of shackles, of solitary confinement, use of psychotropic drugs to ensure compliance. Additionally, there's a significant lack of transparency and accountability in this system. It's often not clear who's in charge. There are multiple chains of command, meaning there's the security chain of command, a chain of command that encompasses the doctors, one for nurses. There's not an integrated management structure here with clear communication across all of these chains of command. So when someone gets very sick or when someone dies, when these terrible things happen, there's a void of accountability. thank you. So it's, you know, it's not really clear who's responsible, and it's not clear who's going to take steps to remedy the situation so that it doesn't happen again. And I'd like to draw your attention to this quote at the bottom of the slide here. This is from the Division of Immigration Health Services website. And I think this gives a clear picture that provision of quality health is not really their aim here. We protect America by providing health care and public health services in support of immigration law enforcement. And whenever I, you know, this is their mission statement, it's across their website, and this is, you know, it's clear that what they're aiming for here. The people held in immigration detention are largely a vulnerable population. Many are survivors of human rights abuses. They may have experienced torture or other kinds of physical or psychological trauma in their country of origin. Many have advanced medical needs related to the trauma that they may have experienced, as well as related to difficulties on the journey over to the United States. Other factors may include that they may have not had regular health care for years, either in their country of origin or upon arriving to the United States. Also, many have chronic conditions, as I mentioned before, and these may have gone untreated for a long time. Unfortunately, Department of Homeland Security does not keep any statistics. It's really unbelievable. They don't keep any statistics on what percentage of the people have chronic conditions or what percentage of the population has mental disabilities. So, you know, NGOs have estimated that the number is about 15%. We really don't know, but it's a significant number that, you know, if people with mental disabilities are not getting treatment, or worse, if they're often just put in solitary confinement because no one knows how to deal with them, obviously these are going to have very serious health impacts for these people. An additional very serious problem is that the intake screenings in the detention centers are very often all too cursory. So the idea is that as soon as someone arrives at immigration detention, that they'll immediately be screened, asked a series of questions by a health professional, and then at that point it's decided whether they are too ill to be in detention, whether they should be relieved into community safeguards, or whether it's okay for them to be in detention. Additionally, at that time, of course, there would be an evaluation of what health needs they have, what kinds of medicines they need, things like that. Unfortunately, these screenings are not taking place immediately for most of these people when they arrive at detention. It may not occur for several days or in some cases for weeks. Additionally, the screenings are often too brief, and sometimes they're not even conducted by health professionals. Security personnel will conduct these screenings. And so again, you can see the health impacts that can result from this are very serious. So Physicians for Human Rights has an asylum network in which we have over 400 health professionals, thank you, over 400 health professionals who perform forensic evaluations for immigrants in support of their asylum applications. We've had this network for about 20 years now. So of course, over that amount of time, we get lots of reports from the health professionals on what they see, what they see in immigration detention centers, what they're hearing from the detainees or those who have been released. Based on the information that we've gotten, in 2003, Physicians for Human Rights published this report, From Persecutions to Prisons, in which we documented the negative health consequences of detention on asylum seekers. In the years that followed, particularly in 2006 to 2009, numerous NGOs undertook similar reports to expose the human rights violations that are occurring in immigration detention. The results garnered the attention of the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of which subsequently wrote a series of articles documenting more and more of the human rights violations that are occurring in immigration detention. Oh, I didn't even realize. Thanks. Okay. So our report, along with this countless other NGOs and the media, completed the first two critical steps of what I've got up here. And so steps to effect change. This is obviously just one model that you can use to effect change to achieve social justice objectives and to hold governments accountable. But this is a model that we found very effective at Physicians for Human Rights. So the documentation and reporting of human rights violations by NGOs, including the report that we just mentioned, From Persecution to Prisons, and other NGOs, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Human Rights First, many of our other NGO colleagues published similar reports. Educating and engaging the media, this goes right along and right after step number one, and so that's what a lot of NGOs did and other advocates with reporters from not only the Washington Post and the New York Times, but lots of other publications to raise awareness, to help them understand the problem, to get them interested in following up and doing more investigation on their own. Number three is to identify the policy window. So, as I mentioned, you know, in 2006, 2009, many reports came up, and at this time, PHR recognized that there was a significant, the policy window, the significant opportunity to make change, to advocate for change. So around this time, we applied for funding from the Langloth Foundation to start a new advocacy project where instead of just us, the, you know, the staff and the lawyers at PHR, instead of us just doing direct advocacy, that we would engage health professionals to give credibility and to give more strength to our advocacy efforts. And so that's number four. So once we received the funding, we hired a full-time person based in Washington, D.C. to work on identifying the various opportunities for health professionals and to really engaging them and getting them interested in the work. Okay, so why do we want to engage them? As I just mentioned, you know, credibility is a very serious thing that health professionals bring to the table. They speak from direct experience, clinical experience, as well as additional experience going into the detention centers, performing medical evaluations and psychological evaluations of people who have endured human rights abuses, as well as endured the abuses and the difficulties in the immigration detention system. Smart policymakers, of course, recognize the value of this hands-on clinical experience. In addition, there's serious public respect for health professionals. The public is far more likely to listen to the arguments advanced by health professionals than they are to listen to the same exact argument advanced by an attorney or other professionals. And finally, health professionals are thought leaders and private advocates on health and human rights. And what I mean by that is, most health professionals in their private practice are already private advocates on health and human rights. They do this at the micro basis, one-on-one with people, or perhaps in small groups, but they already have that mind frame to help people and to recognize health and human rights violations. So to take them from the micro clinical stage onto the macro advocacy stage, working in DC and talking to policymakers, is not as huge a leap as it may appear. Of course, there are some obstacles to engaging health professionals. The first is that they have busy schedules. Most of the people that work with us already have full-time jobs, full-time clinical jobs. So the work that they're doing for us, the advocacy that they're doing, is, you know, in their spare time, they're volunteering, trying to fit it in where they can. Many may have some doubt about their expertise or skills. Even if they have great clinical experience and clinical knowledge, they may doubt or wonder whether that qualifies them to do advocacy with members of the Department of Homeland Security or Department of Justice. They may have doubt about their ability, their communication skills, their ability to communicate their needs and recommendations. They may feel like someone else is better qualified or better positioned to do that. More serious, I think, is that since something we've really had to think about and how to address is that there is a lack of understanding of the government processes and of the advocacy process, and also doubt, in fact, about whether advocacy is effective. Some people have already had the experience of contacting a congressperson, maybe calling, emailing, making some recommendations, and have had those efforts ignored. So there's, they have doubts as to whether at this point they can really make a change. And finally, although less of a concern so far, we're cognizant that there could be potential political concerns for some of the health professionals that we work with. We advance a fairly liberal agenda at PHR, but not all of our health professionals are necessarily on board completely with that agenda. So we have to be sensitive when we make our asks and, you know, look for their recommendations, that they may not be completely in line with where we want to go, but that doesn't mean that their recommendations are not valid nonetheless. So right now we have health professionals involved in a number of interesting projects, and it really depends on their flexibility, their time availability, and their interest and enthusiasm as to how much they want to get engaged. The first one I've listed here is sort of the deepest, most time-consuming project that we have going on. And so it's a medical working group that's involved in ongoing discussions with the Department of Homeland Security and other NGO colleagues. We have three health professionals that are involved in this effort, and so they're going to DC and having regular meetings. So it's a lot of time. They have to be flexible and able to do this, but it's really great, important work that they're doing because they're meeting face-to-face on a regular basis with Department of Homeland Security. DHS actually asked for this medical working group, so they're looking for the ideas. So this is a tremendous opportunity for us and for the health professionals to really have our voices heard and to have our recommendations listened to by DHS. All the rest of the bullet points are examples of things that health professionals can do if they don't have the time or the flexibility to actually go to Washington, D.C. and meet with people face-to-face. I won't read through them all, but just so you see that you know, a lot of these things can either be done over email, on the phone. We can talk them through it and give them the background on these things, and then they can do a lot of it over email and in Word documents and things like this. So I'd like to share the best practices that we've learned so far, and I should mention that we've had this project going only since January of this year, so we're still learning as we go along the way. But we've learned the most important thing is to really take our role as an NGO very seriously, that we are to be the liaison, the educator, and the mobilizer of the health professionals. We make the introductions. We continue to educate the health professionals about the advocacy process, about the situation, or the opportunities to make changes with and give recommendations to Department of Homeland Security. We have to continue to mobilize and energize and keep the health professionals excited about the work and the opportunities here. Timing is key. As I mentioned, I won't go through this again, the policy window that we saw, but when you want to launch a new advocacy program or when you want to bring health professionals on board, it's very important to think about the timing because you want to get them engaged at an exciting time where they really can see the potential for change. We always try to make our requests of the health professionals strategic and modest, particularly with ones that we know are very busy. So we'll ask them to, as I mentioned with the timing, we'll look for opportunities that we really think are a good time to make change or a good time to attract media attention. For example, several months ago, the Refugee Protection Act was coming up again in Congress, and there was a lot of discussion about that. So that was a great time when we reached out to all our health professionals, asked them to contact their congressperson, and let them know that they were in support of the Refugee Protection Act. Of course, not all these efforts will be successful. As you know, it did not pass. But again, next time it comes up again, that will be a strategic moment when we will want to engage our health professionals. And we always want to facilitate their participation in advocacy along with the modest requests. And what that means is if we're asking them to call their congressperson, we'll provide the phone numbers. If we're asking them to write a letter, we'll provide them with a template that they can, of course, make changes to, but they don't have to start from scratch. If we're asking them to co-sign a blog post or a medical journal article or things like that, we can write the first draft of that and then ask for their comments, ask for their changes after that, so that the requests of them are not going to be so time-consuming. They have the opportunity to shape them as they want, but we never would just ask them to go from scratch, go call your congressperson. You know, we're always going to provide information to help them and facilitate their advocacy. Next is to identify and engage health professionals with existing interest. As I mentioned, we have a network of over 400 health professionals, so, you know, off the top of my head, I certainly can't tell you all of their names or their interests, their clinical backgrounds, but we are working to get to know all of them in this way because we recognize that advocacy is going to be the most successful if we have people with direct experience and interest in it making the recommendations to the Department of Homeland Security. We listen to their recommendations and incorporate them as much as possible, but as appropriate, as I mentioned before. So when you have a number of health professionals involved, of course, they're not all going to agree with each other, and they also may not be exactly in line with what we want to push for our agenda. But we'll incorporate them as appropriate, and we'll be sure always to let them know what we are including and what we're not including and why. Communication, of course, is the most important thing. We don't want them to feel like we're disregarding their ideas. We just want to be clear with them why we're incorporating this and not that. And finally, we want to always highlight CV opportunities for the health professionals. Excuse me, this is especially important for the younger health professionals. They're building their resumes, they're building their careers, their experience, and so the opportunity to be a panelist or an advisor or an investigator, something like that, is often quite a draw for young health professionals and more of a motivation to get involved. Okay. And finally, I'd like to share with you some of the results that we've achieved over the past 10 months or so. We've had 80 health professionals engaged in some form of advocacy, and that can be anything from co-authoring a letter to an editor, signing on to a letter in support of the Refugee Protection Act, or actually going to Department of Homeland Security and engaging in advocacy. We're seeing a progression from group activities to solo activities. And what that means is the group activities are the things like signing on to a letter that lots of other people have signed on to. It's, you know, a fairly easy thing to do. Solo activities are things that are more involved, doing a medical journal article, going to meetings, things like that. So of the 80 that we have engaged in advocacy so far, we're seeing more and more of them move from the group activities to the solo activities. And of course, we want to continue to see that progression. We've noticed that there's a growing recognition of the expertise of our health professionals as well as Physicians for Human Rights in regard to immigration detention issues. We're getting more and more phone calls and emails and invitations from Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, as well as our NGO colleagues. One example of this is that in September, we held a mental health roundtable at the invitation of Department of Homeland Security and Department of Justice. So it was an opportunity for us to create this roundtable to invite all the participants to shape the agenda to discuss the mental health issues faced by immigration detainees with mental health issues. And finally, three substantive changes that we've gotten is that electronic records are going to be implemented at all the immigration detention centers across the country. This is a huge win. Right now, all the records are simply paper. The detainees are frequently transferred and the papers don't always go with them. But in January, DHS is going to put out a request for proposals for IT systems to implement this electronic record system. So that's great. The next one is an overhaul of the TARS system. The TARS system is extremely complex, so I won't get into it. But in short, the TARS system has resulted in denial of specialized care to many immigration detainees who have needed it. This system is going to be overhauled, also beginning in 2011. So we're very excited about that, and we hope that it will mean that more and more immigration detainees can get the specialized treatment that they need off-site. And finally, generally, we have a growing awareness of mental health issues. Other NGOs in the past year have put out more reports on mental health issues. And again, this ties back to the recognition of our health professionals' expertise in putting the issue out there. And the DHS is also recognizing it and looking at how to make changes to accommodate the detainees with mental health issues. So I would like to conclude by sharing the very good news that we've gotten additional funding for 2 years to do this program. So we've done it for 1 year. These are the results that we've achieved so far. But we're going to continue to move on these all of these advocacy efforts with health professionals. We hope, you know, over the next 2 years to engage another 200 health professionals and continue to work to achieve the immigration detention reform that's desperately needed. Thank you.